The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme, as we continue our series on the Irish War of Independence, we look at the attacks, reprisals and counter-reprisals that characterised the conflict.
The IRA would keep a close watch on you, and any suspicious activity, basically you would often be tried in absentia, abducted and then shot and executed.
Following our previous programme, where we explored the atrocities and reprisals carried out by the Crown forces, tonight we look in more detail at the IRA.
An IRA gun team went into the hospital operating room, picked him up and carried him out on a stretcher outside the hospital doors and shot him again and killed him.
Most of the houses that were targeted, there was some government official association.
We'll hear more about certain aspects of an often ruthless military campaign, including the burning of big houses and the kidnapping and execution of spies. We're going to begin this evening, though, with a look at the weaponry the IRA used to prosecute their campaign. Guns and ammunition were always hard to come by. As an island nation, everything had to be brought in by ship, and with the ports and the sea controlled by the British authorities and the Royal Navy, it was very difficult for guns to be smuggled in.
Probably the most successful ways of catching guns, or gathering guns up, were taking them off British soldiers, either through bribery or after an ambush, or attacking barracks.
Lar Joy is Port Heritage Director at Dublin Port.
You have to remember, from an Irish point of view, the British authorities, and in particular the Royal Irish Constabulary, controlled the licensing of rifles and, in particular, handguns. So it was a heavily regulated area of Irish life. So they really took anything that they could to use in ambushes. When an ambush did happen, you do find, in many cases, but in particular early days in 1919 and 1920, RIC patrols surrender and they just hand over their weapons.
Years later, when people look back, they tend to overanalyse the guns used in a conflict and may talk about the different marks or the slings they used or whatever. For guys involved in the conflict at the time, they don't really care about much of that. It's, do we have a gun or not? You know, and if I have a gun, what ammo do I have for it? And what limited training do I have? And that is the big problem.
Captain Alan Kearney is a serving officer in the Irish Defence Forces.
What we're at now is the basic level of skill. By practicing the fundamentals of marksmanship as closely as possible with each shot, you get this consistent effect on a target.
Earlier, the History Show visited County Offaly and the Midlands National Shooting Centre near Tullamore. We got a close-up demonstration of a 102-year-old rifle, a Lee Enfield 303 No. 1 Mark III Star, which dates back to 1917.
So this would have been the tool of choice where you could get one during the War of Independence. And this was the British Army staple, if you like. This was their standard issue weapon. So for the volunteers, this was the rifle to have. You know, now they had a whole host of other rifles as well. But it's a battle-proven rifle used during World War I. And it's a particularly good battle rifle. So this is our stock, our trigger. This is our bolt. All right, so these are bolt action rifles. So this piece here is called the bolt, and it moves forward and back in the gun. In combination with this magazine of bullets, this bolt allows us to manipulate. It's manipulated by hand, which will feed the bullets into the chamber of the barrel.
A rifle like this would have been much sought after by the IRA.
Its principal claim to fame, of course, is its 10 rounds, its use of the clips for rapid loading and reloading, its particular action, its mechanism, the setup of its bolt lends itself to rapid firing rounds. And the British Army were particularly well trained in that. So as a combat tool, it's particularly useful.
For a rifle designed in the 1890s, very, very effective in 1919, 1920 and 1921. The average British soldier during the War of Independence normally carried 120 rounds of ammunition with his Lee Enfield rifle. When you look at the IRA lists for how much ammunition that they have, they're going into ambushes with maybe 20, 30 rounds, which means straight away that the average British soldier outgunned the IRA in very, very large numbers.
When you inhale and exhale, at the end of your exhalation, there's a respiratory pause. So that's the good time to squeeze the trigger.
Firing a rifle in controlled conditions at a gun range is one thing, but taking part in an ambush was an entirely different matter. And in a precarious engagement, perhaps the most important factor was the experience of the man firing the gun.
The military controlled that aspect through rigid training and what were called drills. They're drilled in a particular fashion over and over again, trained to do the same thing all the time. So under duress, that's how they behave. So if you imagine on the Irish side, on the side of the IRA during the War of Independence, you had mixed level of weaponry, ammunition as available. Some groups would have had more than others, but ammunition was always precious. Atmospherics, they have very minimal training. They might have the will, but they don't necessarily have the skill. You just have so many unknowns across all those areas. You're dealing with highly motivated people because they have a lot to lose getting involved in this fight. But you don't have the time and space to train them to a high degree. You simply don't have the resources. You know, at early stages, you have a small number of guns that you need to use to capture more guns and so on and so forth. So your capability is very limited. The ex-British Army guys in amongst it would have been very important to their system. Military service has a strong association with history and military history, simply because military history is the only raw combat data we have. And it's part of your professional military education to delve into historical combat engagements, because that's where we draw our learning from. So it's hard to be in the military and not take an interest in history. It's critically important to us.
Thanks to Captain Alan Carney and Lar Joy for talking to us at the Midlands National Shooting Centre in Offaly. Actually experiencing what it's like to fire these rifles really brings home the reality of what it must have been like to be a combatant in this guerrilla conflict. Our main focus tonight is the darkest and most ruthless elements of the IRA's military campaign, principally the executions and disappearances of alleged spies and informers. I'm joined throughout this programme by two guests. Dr. John Borgonovo is a lecturer in the School of History in University College Cork and co-editor of the Atlas of the Irish Revolution. Dr. Padraig Óg O'Rourke is an historian and author who's currently working on a project with UCC to identify all the disappeared in the War of Independence. You're both very welcome. But first, though, we'll hear a short clip from the RTE Radio Archives. It relates to spies and informers. This is the voice of Tom Barry, commandant of the 3rd West Cork Brigade Flying Column, and he recalls how the IRA dealt with spies.
We know at that particular period that men were being sold, and we know there were several types of spies and informers. These fellows had to be silenced, which they were.
Padraig, roughly speaking, how many were quote-unquote silenced by the IRA? I mean, I know it's hard to give an exact...
It's hard to give exact figures because of the number of disappearances and some of the folklore around this, but approximately 200 were killed by the IRA nationwide. And the largest number of those will be in County Cork, where just under 80 people were killed. But in places like Tipperary, there were 16 alleged civilian informers killed in Tipperary. Then I think about a dozen in Dublin. And it happens pretty much across the country, with the exception of six counties in Ulster, with the exception of Mayo and Wicklow, where no alleged intelligence agents are shot. But it's pretty much a nationwide phenomenon. This happens in almost every brigade area.
It was, John, a common occurrence, obviously, during the conflict. Who was the first spy to be, quote-unquote, executed, and why?
The first civilian spy suspect who was killed by the IRA was a guy called Timothy Quinlisk. And unlike a lot of folks who get shot by the IRA, in this case, it's pretty black and white that he was actually providing information to the British. He had been a member of Casement's Brigade in Germany, so he was an ex-British soldier. His father was an RIC constable, and he'd kind of tried to infiltrate the Dublin IRA, had gotten quite close to Michael Collins. And then the Dublin IRA started to believe that something wasn't right with him, and he went south to Cork. Now, the interesting thing about that was some accounts talks about Michael Collins having sussed him out, but there was no coordination at that time between Cork and Dublin. So the Cork City IRA had to come up on their own, figure out that he was suspect, that he was actually seemed to be a police informant and actually trying to infiltrate their organization. And after a few days, they were able to kind of suss him, and they took him out to a wasteland at the edge of the city and shot him.
Shot him 9 times.
Yeah, shot him 9 times and making sure he was dead. Part of the thing with the IRA is sometimes they had little firing parties. Sometimes they weren't really good shots. Or sometimes they really disliked somebody and it's hard to really figure out what happened. In that case, again, the IRA ended up intercepting correspondence between Dublin Castle and the police authorities that implicated him. And it's a pretty open and shut case. But the Quinlis case was seems to be the first civilian shot by the IRA for espionage. And that was in February 1920. But most of the cases that came after that weren't quite as easy to prove.
Mm. Quinlis was one of a number of rather nasty executions that took place in Cork. But tell us about William Mahaly.
William Mahaly was another civilian suspect, another ex-soldier. A year later, in February 1921, he was shot in, by IRA operatives in kind of the city center, and he was taken to the hospital afterwards. But unfortunately for him, one of the surgeons on duty was an IRA volunteer and believed that he was going to live and that the operation was going to be a success, and placed a phone call to notify the IRA that he was, in fact, going to live, and an IRA gun team went into the hospital operating room, picked him up and carried him out on a stretcher outside the hospital doors and then shot him again and killed him that time. So pretty dramatic stuff.
So much for the Hippocratic Oath. Yeah. So he was dragged out from hospital and shot. Was there condemnation from the public? Was there perhaps even condemnation from IRA GHQ?
Well, IRA GHQ wasn't really involved in a lot of these decisions. So a lot of these were local initiatives. There's also always been a lot of mystery about these kind of cases. It's not really clear because people aren't privy to the information that the IRA had. There's very little written documentation about a lot of these cases as well. The public generally would be drawn towards the cases that were dramatically violent like this, or, you know, oftentimes people being labeled. That would grab public attention. But there were also people who were shot, secretly buried, people who there was a great mystery about actually who killed them. Were they killed by the IRA? Were they killed by the Black and Tans? And so there's always been a cloud over a lot of these deaths.
And Páirc, was the execution of spies and informers obviously wasn't, as you've already said, limited to Dublin and Cork. And one of the interesting things is that numerous spies and informers are shot in areas, shot by the IRA, in areas where there's actually very little IRA activity.
Yeah, it doesn't always depend on the level of local IRA activity. It can be that they're suspicious that there have been, maybe the reason there isn't IRA activity is that there's been a lot of IRA volunteers captured or arms dumps given in, and they're shooting people who they might see visiting the Royal Irish Constabulary barracks a lot, and they could be going for something innocent like playing cards or visiting a relative. But once you're in contact with the Royal Irish Constabulary or the British forces, you would be suspected of being a spy. The IRA would keep a close watch on you, and any suspicious activity, basically, you would often be tried in absentia, abducted, and then shot and executed.
They wouldn't have Republican courts or anything like that in order to try somebody who was a potential spy or informer. It would basically be a decision that would come down from, you know, a brigade, a commanding officer or something.
Officially,
like that.
I think that all executions were supposed to be pre-approved by IRA headquarters. The reality is that this isn't happening in the ground level. Usually it's the local brigade leader or flying column commander who makes this decision to execute. There's a small number of cases like Patrick Darcy in West Clare, or I think Sheehan is another alleged spy in the area, where people are actually given a court-martial. But a lot of the time, obviously, these were loyalists in close contact with the British forces, so they were abducted, shot, and the process usually happened pretty quickly.
Now, we think of them as being shot, but that isn't necessarily always the case. In some cases, they were drowned.
Yeah, the method of execution isn't always the same. The standard stereotypical thing is to abduct these people, shoot them, leave the bodies in the roadside with a placard on the body saying, convicted spy, spies and informers, beware. And that's actually an imitation of stuff the British had done on the Western Front in the First World War. But in a number of cases, particularly in the Midlands, in Roscommon, Westmeath and Longford, the IRA are actually drowning people they suspect of being spies. This happens in Roscommon to at least 3 suspected spies, Martin Heavey, who's an ex-soldier, Bernard Ward, another ex-soldier and a petty criminal from Roscommon town, and a kind of notorious case, a guy called Slickfoot Maher. He's called Slickfoot because he has an artificial leg, a wooden leg, possibly the result of being an ex-soldier. When the IRA try to drown him in the Shannon, the leg keeps him afloat. So they actually, to finish the execution, tie sandbags to him. And it's not just limited to that area. was a guy called William Kenny from Greignamana in Kilkenny, and he was alleged to be an identifier. This was someone, not just a spy, but who would actively go around with the British forces on their lorries, pointing out different houses and different suspects to them, to people to raid, people to arrest. He was abducted by the IRA. He was taken to Ballyogan on the River Barrow, and he was drowned. And the IRA gave the reason for drowning him that they were too close to a British Army barracks and they were worried that the firing of shots would attract attention. Now, his body washes up in the River Barrow 6 weeks later. His sister comes and identifies it, but before a coroner's court can actually be convened, the IRA steal the body and they throw it back into the barrow, and it's never recovered. In most cases, it's the standard shooting, the spy and informer notice, but in some cases, people are drowned for execution.
John, just to return to Cork, how many people, roughly speaking, or do we have exact figures, were executed in Cork by the IRA, and were they, as far as you're concerned, all spies?
Well, through the work of Páraic O'Rourke and Andy Bielenberg, we have a pretty good figure for County Cork. It's about 79 civilian suspects were killed by the IRA. Now, of that, it's really hard to make definitive answers about, you know, who was guilty, who was innocent. Some of them were clearly guilty. A few were innocent. A lot of cases fall in between. I think what you can say kind of across the board is the IRA thought people were guilty, who they shot or who they killed. You know, that seems to be the distinction. In terms of why were there so many more people killed in Cork than anywhere else in the country, part of it was the nature of the conflict. It was just a more intense military conflict in Cork. Part of it was you seem to have had a few networks of people who supported the British government who were pretty determined. Part of it seems to have been also just a greater emphasis on gathering information. And the more information you gather, the more suspects you find. And the more suspects you find, the more people you shoot.
Páraic, did the IRA only execute men?
No, of the 200 alleged spies executed by the IRA in the War of Independence, there's actually three women. Now, this contravenes the IRA's official order sent out by IRA headquarters, General Order No. 13, which says you do not shoot women as spies. Women are to be sent into exile. But we know that at least three women were shot as alleged spies for the British forces. The most famous or infamous of these will be Miss Maria Lindsay, who is from Coachford in Cork. She gave information to the British forces, the British Army, about an ambush the IRA had arranged at Dripsy. The British forces came. They captured a number of IRA men, I think five IRA men at that ambush, who were subsequently executed by the IRA. The IRA had Miss Lindsay originally abducted as an informer. They decided to hold her hostage to prevent the execution of these IRA men. And when they were executed, Miss Lindsay and her chauffeur, James Clark, were both executed and their bodies were hidden, were disappeared by the IRA. A second case from County Cork is Bridget Noble. She's from Ardgroom near Castletown Bear. She's seen in the company of RIC men visiting the RIC barracks in Castletown Bear. It may be something as innocent as that she had a romantic relationship with a member of the RIC garrison, but the IRA initially cut off her hair as a punishment for this. They then later raid her home, find correspondence with the British forces and decide that she's a spy. She again is executed and disappeared. And the last case where it happens is a woman called Kitty Carroll in Monaghan, and she's a hackler. She's a putchine maker, and she's been fined by both the IRA and the British forces for making putchine. But what she does is she writes a series of letters to the Royal Irish Constabulary, and she's basically informing on other putchine makers, possibly to get rid of the competition. The IRA decide that either way she's in contact with the British forces, she's crossed them before, she's likely to be a spy, and she is executed and shot. And one of the interesting things about Kitty Carroll's case is that it's often cited as an example of anti-Protestant sectarianism by the IRA. In fact, she was a Roman Catholic.
John, there was a particularly intense period during which the IRA carried out executions. When was that? And as far as we know, why was that?
Well, you start to see a real escalation of the targeting of civilian suspects in about February 1921. In Cork City, it's really clear about 8 or 9 people are killed in about 10 or 12 days. But you also see in other parts of the county kind of a similar escalation. What appears to have happened was the British were getting more successful. They were creating their own intelligence networks. They were having some success. They were putting the IRA under some pressure. And there was a counterstrike kind of planned by Republicans in Cork City, but also in West Cork, also in North Cork, kind of independently of each other. But all of these units were feeling the pressure And the British had also figured out that they had to collect their own information. They had to create their own networks. And those networks seemed to have had a degree of success to the extent that the IRA started to put up feelers and try to figure out who might be informing, who might be passing information. And from that kind of created list, then they decided to take action.
And, I mean, was it to do with the fact that the IRA intelligence operation, particularly in places like Dublin and Cork, had ramped up and was operating at a pretty sophisticated level by 1921?
Yeah, the IRA in parts of Munster and Dublin, they built a pretty sophisticated organization. They had a lot of specialists, and in some areas they really ramped up and really developed highly sophisticated information gathering organizations. In a lot of places, they created very sophisticated and very detailed intelligence gathering operations and networks. And ultimately, they were able to just systematically gather information and try to piece together a jigsaw puzzle: who might be giving information, who might be a suspect, who to watch, who to keep under observation. Keep in mind that they didn't shoot everybody. They had extensive lists of suspects. Hundreds. In Munster, there are hundreds of suspects who were never touched, but they were kept under observation because they were never quite exactly sure who was helping and who wasn't, who was a plausible threat and who was definitely providing information. They didn't just shoot people who were possible threats. They shot people who they actually thought were handing over information. But again, it's a pretty gray area.
What was the tipping point that would decide them, we're going to kill this person or we're going to keep this person under observation? Because as you've already said, frequently they never had any documentary. Sometimes they did, obviously, but more often than not, they didn't have documentary evidence.
It could be as simple as it could be a coincidence. It could be somebody seen, a suspect is seen in an area where somebody is arrested and they don't have an explanation for the arrest. Or somebody is seen communicating with a British Army intelligence officer who then turns around and raids a safe house and has some success. And so you're trying to put two and two together. What seems to happen in Cork City is they're much more willing to act on the information they have. And it's just part of a ruthless mindset they adopt. It's at a heightened part of the war where Republican prisoners are being killed, where there's pretty widespread intimidation of the civilian population of Republican sympathizers. And there's a sense that they have to take drastic steps if they're going to protect themselves, if they're going to remain a viable military threat to the British governance in Ireland.
Then there's the issue of the treatment of the bodies, because, Pádraig, the IRA often wanted to send a message to potential spies and informers. So in cases like Mohali that we've talked to John about, the bodies left out to be discovered, and often it was the case with a sign attached, spies beware, etc., etc. But surprisingly, this didn't happen all the time. I mean, probably only in about half of the cases that you've researched. Tell us about the disappeared.
Yeah, during the War of Independence period, the IRA are responsible for disappearing approximately 100 people. And at the same time, the British forces are involved in it, but to a much lesser extent. There's only about 10 disappeared by the British. There's a number of reasons why people would be disappeared. For example, the case of Michael Hackett, who is an alleged informer taken from Kilkenny and shot by the IRA in Carlow. The IRA report on his killing says, we knew there were other informers who'd been working with him, so we didn't want to advertise the fact that we had caught him and killed him. We wanted to trap others. Sometimes if they're disappearing British soldiers or black and tans they've captured who they suspect are on intelligence work, the reason for hiding them can often be to prevent reprisals. If the British don't know if this person is dead or alive, you know, we may endanger them by taking revenge and burning if they are still being held prisoner somewhere. Sometimes it may be because the IRA feel that their killing is too controversial. For example, the shooting of Bridget Noble in West Cork, that the shooting of a woman may just have been something that was seen as beyond the pale, so they covered it up. In the case of Miss Maria Lindsay, it may have been an element of spite that the five IRA men who were captured on her information and executed, their bodies were not returned to their families. So the IRA may have felt, well, why should this loyalist family have a funeral if we didn't get our comrades back? And lastly, There's a great quote from Jerome Davin, who's an IRA volunteer in Tipperary in Cashel. And he says, quote, "Speaking of spies, I never agreed with leaving their bodies on the road. I always preferred to have the spy buried quietly and to leave an air of mystery about his fate," end quote. So sometimes it's done to kind of strike an air of terror into local loyalists or other alleged informers.
And the discovery of these bodies of the disappeared continues almost to this day. Only last year, a private Chalmers who was disappeared was buried in Grange Gorman Military Cemetery in Dublin. What do we know about his case?
Yeah, he will be one of about, we think there's about 50 people who are disappeared by the IRA whose bodies are actually still missing. Private Chalmers' case was one I came across about 10 years ago when I was writing a book in the War of Independence in County Clare. The story in that case is he was a member of the Royal Scots Regiment. He was from Edinburgh. He was posted with the British Army in Ennistymon, and he went out with a group of British soldiers who were serving a summons on a local Republican to appear in court. And for some reason, when the British were returning in their convoys and their lorries, he simply waved goodbye to his comrades and said, I'll catch up with you later. Now, most accounts of the story locally would say that he went to visit a local girl that he was seeing who was courting in the area. Now, this would have been an exceptionally dangerous thing to do. Not only was he in an area around Moy or Lahinch that was a stronghold of IRA activity, he had actually been shot in an ambush only about 2 miles from the area where he had departed from his comrades. The IRA find this lone British soldier wandering the countryside. They take him. He is court-martialed in this case by 2 local IRA volunteers. He refuses to speak to them. He refuses even to give them his name, most likely because he is seeing a local girl and he wants to protect her from any harassment or retribution. And the IRA executed him the same day he was captured, the 10th or 11th of November of 1921. Now, that body remained in the bog in Drumbawn in Moy, in West Clare, up until May of 2018. I had written the details of this case in History Ireland magazine and published them online. And through the power of the internet, Private Chalmers' relatives years later were doing family history in Britain, put his name in online and said, whatever happened to this guy? And up popped my articles. They got in touch with the Commonwealth War Graves. They in turn contacted Clare County Council and the Gardaí. And I, along with some other local people, had actually, the site had always been marked. Way back to the 1950s, there had been a simple wooden cross. And when I found out Private Chalmers' identity, a stone slab was carved and laid just as a grave marker, not as a commemorative memorial or anything, but just to protect the site from destruction. And the folklore, the local history, the information was so accurate in that case that when the Gardaí came, they simply flipped over that stone, dug down 2 feet, and there was very little of his physical remains intact, I understand, but his uniform, his boots, even the money he had had in his pockets survived. And he was formally reburied in Grange Gorman Cemetery. But it's not that rare a thing. For example, in 1998, an informer called Patrick Joyce was dug up in Barna in Galway. And I think the coins in his pockets had alerted a metal detector or someone working in the area. And in another case, Kirby, who was an informer for the British in Tipperary, in 1990, the deathbed confession or last wish of a local IRA volunteer veteran who was dying was passed to the Gardaí, and it gave them exact information as to where to dig for this body. So the process I'm involved in with Andy Bielenberg and UCC is to identify all of these people. But the question is, if we do identify them and where they're buried, what does the state do next?
Mm. And one of the things for people who work in this field and who are historians of the War of Independence is there's often a very rich oral history of where bodies are. Sometimes that information is spot on, dead accurate. Other times it's not. It's totally false, or it's combining other events. So there are often stories about bodies being in a field or bodies being in a place where actually they turn out to be somewhere else entirely. And again, part of it has to do with the mystery about a lot of these events, that actually relatively few people were involved in these killings, that often local people on the ground would do their own detective work, which could be faulty. And so sometimes we know exactly where someone might be. Sometimes it might be a total wild goose chase.
Now, when it comes to the execution of spies, especially in Cork, the question always arises, John, was there a sectarian element involved? And there is a long and detailed historiography and debates, discussions about whether there were sectarian killings.
Well, this has been a really contested area by Irish historians of the War of Independence. Was there a sectarian element in the motivation? Well, from my own research, I would say probably not, almost certainly not in the cases I looked at. The religious makeup is Protestants make up a larger percentage of the victims than they do in the population. On the other hand, a lot of Protestants were loyal to the government. A lot of Protestants were also actively asserting their loyalty to the government during this period. So it's not surprising that some of them would have been caught up. The place where you see the most disproportionate number of Protestant victims is in West Cork. Now, West Cork is also the place that the British Army said was pretty much the only part of the country where Irish Protestants were providing information to the Crown forces. So were those people who were being shot down there actually spies? We don't know. We do know that there was a reason the IRA were suspecting local Protestants down there. But people don't seem to have been killed out of religious hatred or religious paranoia. It seems to have been a case of trying to connect dots, of trying to connect people to events where they're under a cloud of suspicion. And sometimes those connections are strong and sometimes they're quite weak.
Porrick, would you agree?
Yeah, I think my work largely has been kind of nationwide, and you get a lot of counties, like there's seven alleged spies executed by the IRA in Limerick. All of them are Catholic. You also get three spies in County Clare, again, all Catholic. County Galway, the same thing. So there's a lot of counties where this isn't even an issue. And if you look at the overall figure of, I would say, the exact figure I had was 196. When I did a national study on this, three quarters of those killed were Catholic. One quarter of those killed were Protestant. And that's generally in line with the overall Irish population. It's also
not in the 26 counties.
Not in the 26 counties. But again, you know, sometimes the killings take place in areas that have a very, as John said, in parts of Cork, that would have a very strong loyalist tradition. But overall, again, yes, the IRA do shoot a lot of Protestants as informers. In most cases, they argue that they have intelligence information for this. In some cases, their families and their loved ones, when they write for compensation for the British government, would stress that their relative had been involved in giving information. Latimer, I think, is one of those cases in Leitrim, where his wife actually confirms in her compensation claim that he had given information. But again, for every Protestant they shoot nationwide, the IRA shoot far more Catholics.
John, we know the Crown forces were responsible for the sacking of towns across Ireland, for places, you know, Cork, the centre of Cork, Balbriggan, Trim, and for wholesale destruction of private property, individual houses. But the IRA carried out their own reprisals, and the destruction of the big houses, the country houses, is a big part of this story. Is it exaggerated, or were many of these big houses, the houses of the Anglo-Irish aristocracy, burnt to the ground?
Well, I think it's been a bit exaggerated in terms of popular memory. A number of the big houses that were destroyed in the Civil War. They were also destroyed to prevent occupation, especially by the National Army in the Civil War. In the War of Independence, a number of big houses were also destroyed by the IRA when the IRA learned that they were going to be occupied and used as bases by the Crown forces. In terms of counter-reprisals, there was a significant number of big houses or just loyalist homes that were destroyed by the IRA in kind of the spring of 1921, when the Republicans were again under a lot of pressure. The division commander, Liam Lynch, basically authorized counter-reprisals in response to the destruction of Republican property. So if Republican homes were destroyed by British soldiers or police, the IRA would respond by targeting and burning and destroying big houses. Most of those were people who were associated with the British establishment. The IRA made a point of deliberately burning down the homes of people who had direct connections to British politicians, especially members of the cabinet. And the whole idea was to discourage the government from burning down the property and destroying the property of Republican sympathizers, Republican civilians. And in that, they seem to have been pretty successful, because by about June 1921, the government had decided that this whole reprisal policy should pretty much be abandoned.
Okay, we're going to hear more now about the destruction of Irish country houses. This report is from Lorcan Clancy on how and why the big houses were targeted.
A country house is a house essentially that belonged to a landlord on a landed estate, probably on an acreage of more than 500 acres, a good part of which would have been rented out to tenant farmers originally.
Terence Dooley is a professor in the History Department at Maynooth University and the director of the Centre for the Study of Historic Irish Houses and Estates.
Back in 2001, I published The Decline of the Big House in Ireland. And this was the first attempt that was made to actually map and locate country houses burned during the revolutionary period.
From 1920 to 1923, approximately 300 country houses were burned, about 77 of these during the War of Independence itself.
But if we take a wider lens approach to it and consider that there was a longer revolution that began in 1879 with the land war and the coming together of the land and the national movements, then we begin to appreciate more fully that the landed gentry and the aristocracy was the class that experienced revolutionary activity and violence over an extended period of time much more than any other class.
For Professor Dooley, the burnings of these houses must be considered in light of the land issues of the preceding decades.
And what I'm finding more and more as I research this particular area is the number of abandoned houses that were in Ireland, which begs the question how many landlords had actually left, firstly as a result of the sale of their estates between 1903 and, let's say, 1909, or secondly because of the fear of revolutionary activity. Secondly, because their owners were deemed to be in sympathy with the Crown forces. And therefore, they got caught up in this whole cycle of reprisals and counter-reprisals. And from 1917 onwards, there is this spread of agrarian agitation beginning once again in the West, in what Kevin O'Shea would have called the last phase of land war in Ireland. And, I mean, there's no doubt, but agrarian agitation raises its head once again from 1917 and intensifies in the spring of 1920. And, you know, ultimately it doesn't come to an end until the passing of the 1923 Land Act. So agrarianism or local land issues and questions are undoubtedly a factor in the burning of some houses.
Generally speaking, there were a number of motivations for these burnings.
One, because they were going to be occupied by British armed forces, and so the IRA deemed it necessary to actually destroy them, as in the case of Summerhill and County Meath. Secondly, because they were the homes of loyalist supporters of the British administration in Ireland. Thirdly, for agrarian reasons or local land-related issues, the acquisition and the redistribution of lands. So you could see any of these individually as being, you know, a reason for the burning of a house, but they're usually much more complicated, interlocking and interwoven reasons, sometimes related to the point in time of the burning itself and sometimes related to the historical past.
We bought the house. We bought it unfurnished. So we've been trying to furnish it and generally trying to keep it going, hopefully improve things, hopefully get it to a position where, you know, it will continue on past us, because it's been through so many families now and so many generations that it obviously has a life of its own. So we're just trying to make sure that continues.
Jean Young is the owner of Rookby Hall, a neoclassical country house in County Louth. She's also become the custodian of the house's history.
When we started opening the house to the public for tours, I think 6-7 years ago now, I started doing a little more research and trying to find out things about this house. And very quickly, it's fairly addictive. It's just completely sucked me into studying history, and it's become academic at this point. And it's expanded out, obviously, of researching other houses in the area.
Rookby Hall was built in the 1780s by Richard Robinson, the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Armagh. It remained in the Robinson family until 1913, when it was bought by a man named John Clinton.
The Clinton family would be local. They're Annagassan-based here in Louth. He himself had been living in Newbridge in Kildare for at least 10 years before that, and he had accumulated enough money to buy a large house and apparently wanted to move back to Louth, closer to the rest of his family.
During the War of Independence and Civil War period, 7 big houses in County Louth were burned, but Rookby Hall was spared.
Most of the houses that were targeted, there was some government official association. This one, the occupation at the time, he was a businessman. There was a small attack on the sawmills that were here on the estate, which he himself believed was because he had sold horses to the British Army. But the house itself was never targeted. You know, even before Clinton was here, the Robinson family were long considered excellent landlords, and there's never any major problems with tenants. So there was no obvious reason to target the house.
Ravensdale Park in North Louth was the site of the only big house burning in the county that occurred during the War of Independence.
It had been sold to a Dublin-based property developer several years earlier, so everybody in the area certainly would have known it was standing empty. That appears to have been one of a group of houses in the last few weeks of the War of Independence. There was a military manoeuvre that occurred across what are now the border counties. And there was a series of houses over a few months burnt that potentially might have been used by the army had they come across them. But its situation, it overlooks the main road between Newry and Dundalk, so potentially would have had military use. So in the midst of that, that was June 1921, it was burnt one night. The courthouse in Ravensdale nearby was burnt the same night.
A dimension of the burnings that I didn't really look at in the past, but I'm more interested in now, is the looting that takes place. During the burnings themselves, I mean, the raiders, generally speaking, give the owners or whoever's in residence 15 to 30 minutes to clear out of the house whatever valuables they can. Now, it doesn't give them much time to get very much out, but they'll try to get out possibly the family plate, maybe some family portraits and so on. And then the reports tend to say that the furniture is piled into the centre of rooms, it's sprinkled in with paraffin or petrol, the place is set alight, and generally speaking, everything is destroyed. But, you know, there's more and more evidence coming to light of various important paintings and historical artefacts and so on having been looted. So where these go to or what happens to them is, you know, something that's is of some interest to me at this particular moment in time.
Lorcan Clancy was reporting there. He was talking to Terence Dooley and Jean Young about the destruction of Irish country houses during the War of Independence. Partick, were all these burnings reprisals?
In many cases, it was a question that these large country houses were about to be taken over by the British forces and used as barracks by them. So the IRA would often burn them beforehand when they got information that this was something, an area the British were interested in coming in and establishing a barracks. But in some cases, yes, the burnings of these big houses were done directly as a punishment for the actions of local loyalists. I'm thinking, for example, of Flory Dreeper at Castle Comer in Kilkenny, and she gave information to the British forces about the Coolbawn ambush in June of 1921, and in reprisal for this, the IRA burn her home to the ground. Also in County Clare, you have Henry Beatrum Mills, who is a Protestant loyalist. He had been an identifier for the British forces. The IRA had bombed O'Shaughnessy's pub in Ennis, which was a pub that the British soldiers would drink in, and the British wanted to get their revenge for this because one of their number had been killed. And Henry Mills got into one of their armoured cars, drove around inside it with the British forces, and through the small slit in the armour, he could look out and direct the British forces, talk to them through the slot and say, don't burn that property, that belongs to a loyalist businessman, burn that one, they're Sinn Féiners. And he could identify people along the street while supposedly keeping his own identity secret inside the armoured car. But the IRA discovered that he was the person inside the armoured car, and they actually come and they burn down his house, Millview House in Ennis. And again, in both of those cases, in Henry Beatrum Mills' case and in Flory Dreeper's case in Kilkenny, they both send compensation claims to the British, and they say that they did give information to the British forces, and it tallies with the surviving IRA testimony of why those houses were burnt, that it was a reprisal.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break now, and we'll be back after these.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Our focus this evening is the Irish War of Independence, and we've been talking about disappearances and IRA executions. A number of captured British soldiers during the Anglo-Irish War fared badly, being used, in effect, as hostages, and often being shot dead in retaliation for the extrajudicial killings of the Black and Tans or auxiliaries.
This, however, was not the fate of Brigadier General Cuthbert Henry Tyndall Lucas, commander of the 17th Infantry Brigade based in Fermoy Barracks. Lucas was captured by the Cork IRA while fishing the Blackwater River and held as a hostage. Though he officially escaped, his captors purposely relaxed the guard to allow him to escape rather than be faced with the possibility of executing him. Let's hear now the words of Lieutenant General Michael Brennan. He was one of the leading IRA men in County Clare and a leader of the East Clare Flying Column. These words are from his witness statement in the military archives.
We kept Lucas for some weeks. His presence completely immobilised us, and we daren't do anything which would involve raiding by the British. In addition, he was an expensive luxury, as he drank a bottle of whiskey every day, which I hated like hell to pay for. I was very sorry for him, and more so for his young wife in England, who was very ill, partly after a baby, but mostly, I imagine, from shock. Through Jack Coughlin, who worked in Limerick Post Office, I arranged a system whereby Lucas wrote to his wife and got a letter from her every day. I put him on his honour that he would make no use of this facility to harm us or to escape, and I gave him his letters unopened. He could understand being able to send letters, but receiving them impressed him very much with the machine we appeared to control. He was keen on exercise and spent most of his day saving hay, while he played bridge every night until about 2 a.m. I kept appealing to GHQ to get rid of our prisoner, but all I got was news that East Limerick would take him over soon. We had realised by now, of course, that nobody wanted Lucas, as his presence held up all activities. We also knew that GHQ and the Dáil government were very embarrassed by him. Threats had been made publicly that he would be held against other prisoners, and obviously we couldn't play this game indefinitely against the British. When a Dublin visitor commented, "Why the hell doesn't he escape?" I saw the solution of the difficulty. We spent 3 days in Carrickonlish and then moved to a vacant house near Herbertstown Bruff. We took Lucas for long walks across the country, and I noted with satisfaction that he studied the topography carefully from every hilltop. Up to this, we had always left a man on duty outside his bedroom window at night, and now, when the room was on the ground floor, we withdrew this man. At first, nothing happened. He may have suspected a trap. But when we got up on the second morning, our prisoner was gone.
The words there of Michael Brennan of the East Clare Brigade of the IRA. Porrick, did the IRA like to go for high-profile targets, or did they just take whoever fell into their ambush?
Well, it was rare that they would capture somebody as high profile as General Lucas. But throughout the War of Independence, it was a common thing for the IRA to take prisoners. And the big problem was, you know, they don't have any purpose-built jails for them, so they would have to hold them in local safe houses and decide then whether these people should be shot, should be held as hostages in the hope of preventing the British executing someone or striking a deal, or whether they should release them. And if we look at the time of the truce, the ceasefire at the end of the War of Independence in July of 1921, the IRA are actually holding 8 British soldiers nationwide captive who they just released that morning. One problem they have here is deserters from the British Army, people who are fed up with soldiering, often walk straight into the arms of the IRA. These people are found in the countryside. And initially, in the early stages of the war, this is a very valuable source of intelligence for the IRA. It's a source of ammunition. These guys often want money, so sometimes they'll go back to their barracks, take a small punishment, and then steal a number of rifles and sell them to the IRA. And in a small number of cases, like Peter Monaghan in Cork, Walter Stennings in Kerry, Charlie Chidley in Offaly, you had a small number of British deserters who actually defected, joined the IRA and served in IRA flying columns. The problem for the IRA was, though, as time went on, it became very difficult to tell genuine deserters who were fed up with their time in the British Army and just wanted the money to get on a boat and go home, and British intelligence agents who came into the countryside posing as deserters. And by June of 1921, the IRA headquarters sent out General Order No. 27, and that basically said, look, we've been having problems with deserters, don't take them all as genuine. keep them prisoners separate from your safe houses, keep them under guard, don't trust them. And at that stage, by April, May, June of 1921, head office is catching up, because at that stage the IRA are just shooting a lot of people who are being presented to them as deserters in the British Army.
Okay, who was George Robertson and why was he so dangerous?
George Robertson was one of these deserters who, in October of 1920, in the company of another British soldier, Lance Corporal Alexander McPherson, walked into the hands of the West Clare IRA at Connolly, just a few miles to the west of Ennis. And they claimed to be deserters from the British Army. And it's an early enough stage in the war, October of 1920, that the IRA treat them leniently. In fact, we even know from IRA testimony, they were taken around to local dances. They were held in the IRA men's homes. And I suppose they were figuring out a way that they could get money for them, send them back to Britain, or decide what to do with them. One of these soldiers, the older one, McPherson, disappears overnight. He escapes, he goes straight back to his barracks. The IRA panic and they say, what are we going to do with the second soldier, Robertson? He can identify us, his pal has gone, they're obviously not genuine deserters, and the IRA execute Private George Robertson and they bury him in Ballynoe Bog. No sooner has he been executed than McPherson, the supposed deserter who escaped, arrived back with a large force of the British military, and they began raiding the houses he had been held in. And McPherson was able to lead them to every single house he had been held in. And he walked into one house and he confronted the homeowners and said, I was held here as a prisoner. You are rebel sympathisers. And they said, no, we've never seen you. McPherson says, yeah, turn over that chair. And when they turn over a chair in the kitchen, McPherson has carved his initials and a date. He had actually marked the woodwork of all the houses he had been held in. So in that case, you have somebody who's coming out supposedly as a deserter, but we have this evidence that they actually go back to the British Army and lead them to the places they've been held and are gathering intelligence on the local IRA. And McPherson, as I said, escapes the IRA's clutches. He eventually goes back to his home in Scotland, but Private Robertson was executed and his body is still in Ballynoe Bog in West Clare.
Part of the thing with the British Army in this period is their morale is pretty low. It's after the First World War. A lot of these guys are conscripts. They have poor discipline. A number of soldiers are passing ammunition and arms to the IRA. A few defect, a lot desert, and a number leave barracks without passes to go out. They're trapped. They're getting claustrophobic. So they go off and they enter into IRA-controlled territory. And some of them are genuine deserters and some of them aren't. And at a certain point, the IRA decides that they can't take a risk. And those poor folks are shot and executed.
Tell me what happened to Compton Smith.
Major Compton Smith was a British Army officer. He was abducted by the IRA in Blarney, probably as part of a coordinated effort to conduct counter-reprisals to prevent further executions of IRA prisoners. He was maintained by the kind of the Dunamore Battalion area of the IRA, very close to where Mrs. Lindsay had been kept. He was quite popular with his captors. He wrote about singing songs with them. He left his watch to one of his officers who was looking over him, and he was eventually shot by the IRA. And it's those kind of human stories and human dramas.
That sounds a little bit like Frank O'Connor's Guests of the Nation.
There are multiple, yes, it's very similar to Guests of the Nation, but there are multiple, this is not the only case where the IRA abduct or capture British soldiers who they keep for a long time and then eventually have to shoot. And a lot of times it doesn't sit well with them because, and this is also part of what happens in warfare, a lot of times you have to kill people who you have no personal feelings against. And actually when you get to know them, it makes that task even that much harder. And there are multiple cases of that, not just in Cork, but across any place where there was a lot of fighting, these kind of cases crop up.
But Parig, there were instances where some who were taken by the IRA and who were held were not shot, were left alone. Left to live.
Yeah, it very much depends on the regiment they belong to and how that regiment has been behaved locally and whether that regiment has been involved in widespread reprisals or has been involved in killings or assassinations. For example, if you read Tom Barry's book, Guerrilla Days in Ireland, he stresses that he didn't really have any issue with the Liverpool regiment, but he had big problems with the Essex regiment, who were regarded as scoundrels and murderers. And there's one example, if we take the Essex regiment, there a number of them are captured after an IRA ambush in Tourine, and basically basically they're lined up and they're given a warning, you know, from here on out, you behave yourselves or the gloves come off. And the Essex Regiment go back that evening, carry out a number of reprisals, a lot of them, funny enough, on the homes of loyalists. But after that, the next time the IRA capture Essex Regiment prisoners is in Bandon in February of 1921. They capture two members of the Essex Regiment in a raid on the town, two members of the Royal Marines. The two Essex soldiers are executed and the Royal Marines are sent back to their barracks with a note saying, tell the Essex we are going to continue from here on out because they have not behaved themselves or kept their promises. So a group like the Royal Marines, Tom Barry was quite happy to let them go because they were regarded as being inoffensive and following the rules of war as they were. But the Essex he had no sympathy for.
And again, didn't have much sympathy for Oxies either.
No, but in other cases like the Clonfin ambush in Longford, Sean McCone, who's the flying column leader there, he actually cares for wounded auxiliaries that he has captured in that ambush, and a number of them later testify in his favour at his court-martial. Compare that to somewhere like the Scrimoge ambush in Roscommon, where the IRA capture two black and tans, and as they're crossing the Shannon, escaping from the ambush, they decide, well, we can't hold these guys prisoner, what will we do with them? So they drown the first one, Buchanan. The second one, Evans, is kept alive long enough that he teaches the IRA how to use the Hotchkiss machine gun they've captured, and then they shoot him and put him in a bog. And sometimes it's not just that they can't deal with the prisoners they have. If we look at the Drumkeen ambush in Limerick, which is the largest, most successful ambush outside of Cork, the IRA capture two members of the RIC afterwards, Sam Adams and Michael Doyle, and both of them were executed by a guy called Morris Mead. Morris Mead actually knew Doyle, who was a black and tan from Dublin. The pair of them had lived within a mile of each other, and obviously if he let Doyle live, he could identify him. The other thing about Drumkeen is that a number of the British forces in it were wearing peacock feathers in their hats. That was significant because the British forces had raided Catter Gillmore House, where the IRA were attending a dance. They executed a number of the IRA men they took prisoner, and afterwards they shot the peacocks, put peacock feathers in their hats. So when these guys were found at Drumkeen, the IRA said, well, these are clearly the guilty parties. Now is our chance for retribution.
I mean, the IRA often let prisoners go. For much of the War of Independence, off-duty British soldiers were left alone, weren't touched. It was only as the war really escalated and both the Republican, especially the state violence, the Crown Force violence escalated, that you start to see this kind of ruthlessness really creep in.
And Parig, I think there was payback of some kind for the killings in North King Street in the Easter Rebellion of 1916, because they involved the South Staffordshire Regiment.
Yeah, the South Staffordshire Regiment gets stationed in Cork City during the War of Independence. And I'm not sure that the local IRA in Cork would have been aware exactly of what they had done in Dublin. But one of the first things they did after arriving in Cork City was they shot dead an ex-soldier. And that got the back of a lot of the local community up. They were also involved in killing a number of IRA prisoners they captured. And there's a particularly gruesome incident the evening before the truce in the War of Independence, when two members of the Royal Engineers and two members of the South Staffordshire Regiment are captured. These four soldiers are unarmed. And what seals their fate really is that two nights before, the South Staffordshire Regiment had captured and killed a 19-year-old IRA volunteer, Dennis Spriggs, and the guy who ordered the execution of these South Staffordshire soldiers, Daniel Halnan, was actually a personal friend and workmate of Spriggs. So again, it often came down to local stuff. Had they been different soldiers from a different regiment and South Staffordshire's in Cork, there were plenty of other British soldiers from regiments captured that evening who were released unharmed.
Okay, so what I'm getting is that both sides were responsible for many indescribable acts of violence. In the case of the Crown Forces, they had the protection of their superiors. The IRA matched perhaps their brutality and relied on fear to prevent people informing on them. But I suppose this is the unfortunate reality of war. Dr. John Borgonovo and Dr. Pádraig Óg O'Rourke, thanks to both of you for joining us this evening. That's just about all we've got time for on this evening's programme. My thanks tonight to all our contributors and also to the archivists in the military archives for their assistance with this programme. You can find podcasts of all our episodes on our website, rte.ie/history. Our researcher is Liz Gillis, Cara O'Hare was on sound, and our reader tonight was Daniel Costello. Join us at the same time next week when we'll be continuing our series on the Irish War of Independence. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.